The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. First Thursday in November. Fall is definitely here with us. We got a great show for you guys today. We're going to start off in the Middle East with a first-time guest here to Capital Thinking. That's Ambassador Joseph LeBaron, a guy who's had a fascinating career, and he served as the United States ambassador to two countries in the Middle East. He was the ambassador to the state of Qatar from 2008 to 2011, and also from 2003 to 2006 was our ambassador to the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. He's also spent a lot of time in various other diplomatic missions throughout the Middle East, as well as serving as a political advisor to the United States Special Operations Command, which is based down in Florida. So, Ambassador LeBaron, first, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Well, listen, we wanted you on. We've spent a lot of time on the show this year analyzing various elements of the Arab Spring, which bled literally and figuratively into the Arab Summer. And now with the recent news out of Libya, I guess we could say we've reached the Arab Fall. And it looks to me like with the fall of those dictators in various places, we're entering a new phase. So what do you think Arab Spring and Summer has led to? Where's Arab Fall and Winter going to take us here in the next few months?
I love that analogy. You know, when I think about what's underway in the Middle East, including North Africa, I don't think of it as anywhere near a calendar year analogy, in that we are into an Arab fall. We are in the first pages of the first chapter of a very long volume of structural change in the Middle East and North Africa. It's a long, uncertain path, but it's underway. It's huge. It's significant in a number of different ways. And so I think what is underway is very early, and we should approach it as such. I would encourage you to think of it that way, as the beginning of a very long process that will lead to structural change in the MENA region.
Well, obviously, America is a country itself founded on overthrowing somebody that the people thought didn't represent their interests, and then going through, you know, a struggle that I think folks forget their history, forget the struggles we had after the revolution to really put together the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that we have today in the form of government we have today. It looks to me like the struggle for some of these countries in the Middle East is going to take a little longer than even our struggle. Sort of walk us through what some of the key elements of a pathway to democracy for a Middle Eastern nation that's having this transition might look like in the next few years.
I think a useful concept is that of equilibrium. I think these individual countries are seeking a new kind of equilibrium based on religious factors, political factors, economic factors, all combining to present challenges in a path towards a new equilibrium country by country. And we will see that play out in interesting and important ways for the business community. It's all associated, I think, with a concept of risk and just how much risk is there of instability, how we deal with risk across its various manifestations. But I expect to see a strong push towards the use of democratic means and processes to arrive at an equilibrium in which there is majority rule but protection of minority rights, including those secular populations that are found in each Arab country. It will be a fascinating process, and I look at it as a search for a new equilibrium.
I see. Well, I know a lot of people, I mean, when I sit around and watch this story from afar, and I talk to some friends both in and out of the policy world, I think there seems to be a very common fear. There's great elation that we've seen the overthrow of some dictators who were, you know, in many cases appalling leaders in their treatment of people, but there's a concern that what we might get is even worse, particularly if democracy simply becomes a vehicle for some form of Islamic extremism to take over in some of these countries. So talk to us about that fear. Is it legitimate?
I don't think so. I think that we have to be very careful with our definition of terms. If you're speaking about Islamists, that's one thing. If you're speaking about Islamic extremists, that's another. If you're thinking about violent extremists, that's a third. I think we have to be very careful. There is, throughout the Middle East, a strong orientation, a strong identity bound up with Islam. That is to be expected. It is to be understood as a fundamental part of this evolution underway. And should the West, should the international community oppose this? Not at all. It goes back to this search for an equilibrium that is new, that recognizes the importance of Islam in the political structure and through a democratic process. I think it's very important to understand that and let that be our guide rather than some reactionary, reflexive antipathy or fear of an Islamic tradition. Now, it's one thing to talk about violent extremism. It's quite another to talk about an Islamist tradition. There are moderate Islamists. I think what we see in Tunisia is evidence of that. And I am actually optimistic that this evolution will lead to a more stable rather than a less stable MENA region.
So we talked about that fear being irrational, in your viewpoint. Talk to me also, one of the other things that comes up most commonly is, what does this mean for women's rights, religious freedom? Political dissidents tend to be, you know, three groups that, from afar look like they've really borne the brunt of, having dictatorial rule in a lot of these countries, over the last few decades.
Well, the greatest thing about the democratic tradition and the use of that tradition as reflected in Middle Eastern practices and consonant with the cultures and the societies there is that the fundamental idea of a majority rule but minority rights is embedded in that. And that includes women, women's rights, children, secularists, religious minorities. All of this is a way of approaching the evolution underway in the Middle East that really is takes us to an optimistic readings of where we're headed and what we can support and what the future will look like. I think there's evidence of that based on what Ennahda is saying in Tunisia, what the Libyan new leadership is saying. I think what's underway in Egypt, all of these systems, all of this transition really is a cause for optimism. And I, having been involved with the Middle East now for four decades, having seen cycles come and go and trends come and go, I think this is a very optimistic time for the greater region.
Well, you mentioned cycles and you mentioned business earlier. So talk to me a little bit about how this change really impacts investors. The Middle East has, you know, some pockets where there's been just tremendous prosperity, but some of these countries where we're seeing a transition have tremendous poverty. And do they have significant opportunities as well for the business community in the next few years?
Absolutely. The way I approach it is I think of the Gulf States as an engine of growth for the MENA region. You take the Gulf States collectively, the six, they have a $1.1 trillion economy. There is a role, a systemic role, for the Gulf States to play in the development of the MENA region, of the Middle East and North Africa. That development role is recognized already by several of the GCC states, the Gulf Cooperation Council states. I'm very encouraged by that. The states that you describe as impoverished, sort of lacking in development, that's true, but they have immense reservoir of human capital. And the Gulf States do not. There is a way of integrating that economic engine for growth stemming from the Gulf with the human capital that is present in the rest of the region and combine that in a way that leads to tremendous opportunity for business, indigenously, and internationally. Bound up with that is something I pointed to earlier, and that is the idea of risk and how to offset risk for the international businesses looking to engage the Middle East. How do they think about risk? What I've noticed is that businesses outside the region tend not to differentiate the risk that exists country by country. The amount of political risk, the extent of political risk in the Gulf, for example, is far, far less than the political risk in parts of North Africa. And yet, the idea is it's risky out there throughout the MENA region, and my company is not going to get involved, really is unformed and should be reexamined. At the same time, as this reexamination of to get a more sophisticated understanding of the risk that exists in the region, there's a role for governments to play, both governments such as the United States, international organizations such as the World Bank, and the individual states themselves. How can these players in the economic system help U.S. business, other businesses, offset this risk? I'm thinking of course, political risk insurance. The Ex-Im Bank, for example, assists companies, large companies, small companies, in financing the export of U.S. goods and services. So they help the exporters. OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, that's focused on investors.
Yeah.
Programs for offsetting risk for those.
And
the World Bank has something as well. So this concept of risk is endemic, I think, for U.S. business and how they think about the region.
Well, Ambassador, I think we're gonna cut things off there. I think we should definitely continue this conversation at a later date. We're certainly gonna see numerous evolutions of push for democracy in the Middle East, and I know we'll want to have you back to chat about those. We've been joined by Ambassador Joseph LeBaron, talking a little bit about the Middle East. We're gonna be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking right after this commercial break.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Well, one of the things we have spent a lot of time on this show talking about is the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act and financial reform, which continues to reverberate throughout Washington on a number of levels as we struggle to rebuild our economy, and as we watch across the Atlantic Ocean and see some of the same struggles go on with Greece and the European Union. We've got Todd Cranford with us. Todd's a regular here on the show, somebody who spent some time working on Capitol Hill as a counsel to Barney Frank, who at one point was chairman to the House Banking Committee. House Financial Services Committee. Todd, welcome back to the show. I want to talk to you a little bit about backlash from consumers to a lot of what's going on with Dodd-Frank. If I recall correctly, just this week we've heard that Bank of America, which is one of the biggest banks in the United States, is not going to go through with a promise to have new debit card fees. And presumably that's because of some consumer backlash. And they were going to impose those fees because they needed to make up some money due to some changes in Dodd-Frank. So tell us about those changes, what it does for Bank of America, and if they're not going to go through with these fees, are we going to get it socked somewhere else if we're a Bank of America customer or if we're a customer of one of these other big banks?
Yeah, good afternoon, Kevin. It's always a pleasure. Yes, that has been a significant feature in the news related to the banks the past few days. And Bank of America and a number of other banks, including SunTrust Bank and Wells Fargo, have decided to forego this fee that you just referred to, which would be a monthly fee charge to consumers who use their debit cards for making purchases. Now, it varied a little bit from bank to bank. Some banks were charging less than the $5 that B of A had announced, but most of the big banks were considering, and some had even already implemented their fee for this use. And as you mentioned, consumer backlash was swift, loud, and apparently decisive, because all of these big banks have, in the last week and a half to 2 weeks, pulled away and pulled back from these fees. And are, you know, for example, Bank of America, in one of their public statements, say, you know, we have heard our customers and we are pulling back. Well, they probably heard them 2 months ago when they announced this fee originally, but thought that they could still push it through. because in the wake of one of the significantly controversial provisions of Dodd-Frank, the Durbin Amendment, which pulled back or prevents the banks from charging fees to retailers when customers use their debit cards. Everyone knew at that time that the banks were going to find some way of transferring that fee somewhere else to the customers, most likely, to keep the significant amount of money that they were making on these fees. Right now, due to legislation, they've lost, well, I shouldn't say they've lost, they now don't have the opportunity to make close to $11 billion a year. That's with all of the fees that have now been restricted or curtailed under Dodd-Frank.
That seems $11 billion. That's real money.
Yes.
So with these fee increases, you know, one of the things I've heard in a lot of these debates, Todd, at the policy level is whether or not the stuff is transparent. The president has hit on that. I know during Dodd-Frank there was a lot of discussion about, is it transparent? I mean, I get my monthly statement from the bank, and you know, the fees that you get, whether or not it's an ATM fee or this fee or that fee, it's all on there somewhere. So how do consumers sort of stay abreast of what the changes are month to month or over time as banks sort of scramble to comply with Dodd-Frank?
Well, you know, transparency is an important issue. It has been the focal point of a lot of the regulatory reforms over the past several years, not just with Dodd-Frank. And in short, transparency often is in the eyes of the beholder. And although that sounds somewhat cliche-ish, transparency is not just about letting customers know what fees they're being charged and why, but how are they being disclosed? Are they coming in bulk mailings that get tossed because people are inundated with bulk mailings? Consumers who bank online, are there online accounts? Is there some notification on the online account? Are they receiving phone calls from their bank? Some of which was legislated in Dodd-Frank and previous pieces of legislation, but not all of it. So how the banks notify customers is still somewhat of an issue. But because of Dodd-Frank and some of the consumer legislation that preceded it, particularly with credit cards, there are increased notifications that have to be made in bolder fonts, set out in an easily comparable manner so that consumers do have a better idea of just what fees they're being charged and why. Now, kind of further to the question that you just asked, I think the transparency issue clearly is not the focal point of the fees that Bank of America and SunTrust and Wells Fargo have decided not to charge right now, because they will tell you, hey, we were out front, we were open, we told you this is what we're going to charge. The president, Senator Durbin, and other policymakers have decried these fees and said, I think interestingly, that this is one reason why stronger regulation needs to be in place.
Gotcha. You
know, I'm not sure that is really a good example of why regulation needs to be in place. And I think my view and that of many others, this is open and free competition. And if the banks choose to try to charge these fees, consumers can do what they apparently are doing, pulling away.
Well, Todd, let me talk about some of the downsides of some of these changes.
Sure.
I for one, could not stomach another Capital One Alec Baldwin commercial during the football games talking about the benefits of that card. But, you know, I know my wife is always keen. Once a year we get something from our credit card company about, you know, a companion ticket because we've got an airline-affiliated bank card and whatnot, and our chance to sort of cash that in. And there's a lot of money wrapped up in rewards programs that maybe goes away if banks are concerned about their profit margins going forward. So what about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, clearly, where they can't make money one way, they will make it another. I think we have already started to see and will see a continuation of lower interest on deposit accounts, for example, increasing existing fees. They may not create new fees, this new debit fee was intended to be, but they'll increase existing fees on ATMs, late payment fees, wire transfer fees, all of the fees that already exist. It's likely that they will be incrementally increased so that it's not as big a hit from a publicity standpoint or from the pocketbook standpoint that this debit fee could have been. And I think that's where banks will inevitably try to make up some of the money that they're losing through the legislation. I think we should make no mistake about it that the banks will continue to try to make back the money that they feel they're not going to be able to make on those other fees. I think any thought other than that was naive to begin with. And, you know, to come out and accuse the banks of making too much profit, which some policymakers have said, you know, I don't think is going to be a winning argument in the end.
Gotcha.
It's going to be difficult to legislate capitalism.
Todd, I got a friend who's not in banking but is in financial services who works for a credit union, and he seems to be crowing about how Dodd-Frank is terrific for that segment as an alternative to the big banks. Why is he saying that?
Well, you know, historically, credit unions were a good alternative to the big banks because they charged lower fees. Many of them still did banking on much the same basis as banks historically had done, of being in the community, knowing their customers, and being willing to lend at lower interest rates and to lend money to individuals and entities that may have difficulty getting loans from some of the big boys. And I think the antics and the legislation over the past few years have only increased the opportunities for, you know, these community banks and credit unions that, you know, assuming that they are on solid financial ground standing themselves, they can take up a lot of the slack that will come over when people use them as alternatives. I am probably another example of many people who have a credit union account and bank with one of the major banks for different reasons.
Interesting. Will you see any other big disputes on the horizon for these folks?
Well, yeah. You know, as Dodd-Frank implementation continues, I think you mentioned that at the outset, that it is a long way from being over. And as Dodd-Frank implementation continues, many of these banks, the big ones, the medium-sized ones, and the small ones, will continue to be in speaking with the regulators and the policymakers to try to ward off any unintended consequences, as well as some of the intended consequences of the legislation. And I think the public policy battle that the banks are going to have to contend with is where they decide to make up for the lost revenues that they are facing in the face of the legislation. And while they may be doing things that are perfectly legal, they are going to have to deal with the hit in the public arena when they try to make what is going to be termed as obscene amounts of money.
Well,
you know, I'm not passing any judgments. I'm just predicting how it will be characterized.
Usually the term obscene amounts of money refers to other people besides what you're making. So at least that's my experience. So, well, Todd, thanks for joining us and giving us this update on what's going on in consumer backlash in the banking industry. We're going to take a little break here. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking in just a minute.
Have a great day.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, every once in a while, we like to spend some time catching up with folks across the legal sector, talking about things we didn't know and shining a spotlight on some new stars. We are joined by Stephanie DeVinny, who's a member of the Fox Rothschild Litigation Department, and she works a little bit there in commercial litigation matters, construction work, etc. But we're really here to talk to Stephanie about the world of higher education. She's got a unique backstory, a graduate of the Dickinson School of Law in Pennsylvania. She's been elected by the alumni to serve on the Pennsylvania State University Board of Trustees, which is a very prestigious appointment at a fairly young age. And we wanted to talk to her a little bit about what it takes for a young lawyer to get in such a position of responsibility in the higher ed world, and also talk about a lot of the challenges she faces sitting on the board of trustees for one of the nation's largest universities at a time when higher education is facing a number of different challenges and strains. So, Stephanie, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about how you became a board member there at Penn State.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I'm so happy to be here. Basically, it really started by every year I would get the nomination form seeking nominations for members of the Board of Trustees, and I kept thinking to myself, one of these years I need to try that. And probably about in 2009, I thought, you know what, there's no better time than the present, and as part of the process, I needed to get 50 nominations to get on the ballot. So I went out, got my 50 nominations, basically emailed everybody I knew that went to Penn State or knew people that went to Penn State and said, please nominate me. So I got on the ballot in 2009. Everyone told me it's, you know, really a hard position to knock off any incumbents, and everybody wants to be on the Board of Trustees at Penn State. The first year I didn't make it. There were 12 people running. I came in fourth place, beat all the non-incumbents, but all the incumbents kept their spots. And then in 2010, I decided, well, you know what, I already have the framework in place. I'm going to try once again. So when it came time to seek nominations, I basically did a lot of social media networking, a lot of Facebook, a lot of LinkedIn, a lot of electronic mail. I was able to get my 50 nominations a lot faster the second time around. And when the election results came in, I narrowly won by 113 votes and got the third seat. So I'm now on for a 3-year position, and basically it's an election by the alumni, and I'm the first graduate of the Dickinson School of Law who's not an undergraduate of Penn State to be elected by the alumni. And to me, it's such an honor, and I'm so proud that I'm able not only to represent my law school on the board, but to just be part of the, you know, Penn State governing body and to represent the alumni on the board.
Well, I'm sure it's a job that comes with a lot of perks, maybe even some football tickets to Happy Valley, and we can talk about that in a minute. But one of the things I want to talk to you a little bit about is Penn State's a land-grant university. That's a special class of universities that have a distinct mission that's actually given to you by the federal government. So talk a little bit about that unique mission and some of the challenges a land-grant faces in today's economic world.
Yeah, it is really challenging, and probably the reason why it's so challenging is, you know, funding. Every year our appropriation from the state decreases, and I should probably say, from the get-go, these are just my views, not the views of the university or the Board of Trustees, give that disclaimer. But every year our funding, our appropriation decreases. So because the school is always very proactive about looking at things, in April of 2008, they actually formed a land-grant mission task force and that's led by Rodney Erickson, who's the executive vice president and provost. And basically, he, along with the council, were charged with basically looking at the land-grant mission of the university and trying to address several questions. And some of those questions involved, you know, how does technology and all the changes that we're seeing, how does that fit in with our land-grant mission? Some of the other things that the task force was charged with looking at was, you know, is there a certain land-grant activity that Penn State should be focusing on? And, you know, how do we basically get all out to all of the people? We have a lot of, cooperative extension is one of our biggest areas of the land-grant mission. Another thing is, how do we deal with, you know, keeping up with the land-grant when we have a smaller and smaller proportion without having a huge increase in tuition? And part of the whole entire idea of having a land grant is to make sure that college is accessible to everyone, not just the people that can afford it. And, we want to make sure, is that changing because of, are we not making it affordable? So the task force looked at that and also looked to other land grant universities and what are they doing and what can we learn from them. And basically, how do we adapt this global environment where education is not just within your state, not just within your country, but it's really becoming worldwide. We're seeing more and more students from across the world that want to come to Penn State and want to get a Penn State university, and how can we partner with, you know, other countries to, you know, and still fulfill the land grant mission?
Well, definitely. So let's talk about some more of these challenges. Obviously, you've got, I think, a growing body of evidence that there is a student loan crisis and really a college affordability crisis. And
yeah,
you talk a lot about how land-grant university, one of their key missions is access to a high-quality education. So how do you square that circle?
Well, basically, we're lucky, and this is actually one of the recommendations that the task force came up with, is Penn State is unique in that there is the, you know, main campus and University Park, which houses, you know, tens of thousands of students, and then we have 19 Commonwealth campuses across the state of Pennsylvania. So just from a geographic standpoint, we're really able to reach a lot of citizens of the state of Pennsylvania. And we're looking to change. There's a tuition differential there. Commonwealth campuses are less expensive than University Park campus. And the Commonwealth campuses predominantly originally were 2-year campuses and everyone migrated to University Park. And that's starting to change. And we're seeing a lot of the Commonwealth campuses turn into 4-year college degrees. And that sort of falls into another recommendation is increasing opportunities for adult learners. How are we going to get more adult students in? And by making these Commonwealth campuses 4-year campuses, we're making the college education more accessible to more people. This particular issue is really close to my heart. My husband, after a 12-year hiatus, went back as an adult student and finished his Penn State education at Penn State Brandywine. And we actually recently just met with the development director over there to talk about how wonderful Penn State Brandywine's campus was, how the administration just worked with my husband to be able to help him get his degree as quickly as possible and helped him get credit. So there's really a focus on Penn State administration wanting to make the education more accessible and more affordable all across the state, and not just to, you know, your 18 to your 22 year olds, but, you know, people who may have gone to a couple years of college and for whatever reason not completed it. So that's one way. Another really interesting thing that we're doing, which is completely growing, this sort of falls into the whole technology, is the World Campus. You may have seen, I know it's a real popular commercial during the football games, if you watch them, though we are everywhere. We are the World Campus, and it's just been growing by leaps and bounds, and it's really helping to fill pockets of education and where we have people from all over the country studying and taking classes on the World Campus. And the really fun part, which I think is terrific, is some of them actually come to University Park for graduation, having never set foot on the campus or stepped on the campus, and they come with their list of things that they need to do, you know, get their picture taken with the lion, get some sticky buns, go to the creamery, and it's just a great opportunity, I think, and we're looking to, you know, continue to grow the World Campus, figure out what the needs of the World Campus are. In fact, I also sit on the Graduate School Alumni Society, and we've just talked about amending those bylaws to add a representative from the World Campus, because it's grown so much and we want to make sure that they're represented, you know, at a graduate school level. But, you know, the World Campus is actually all levels. But that's really sort of some of the ways that we're looking to try and bridge these gaps by keeping things affordable, keeping it accessible to everyone. Another area we're looking in is financial aid. You know, how can we make sure that there's financial aid opportunities for Penn State students? We have to, you know, explore all the avenues. And so we're basically, you know, continuing to look at that.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're going to have to wrap things up there. We've been joined by Stephanie DeVinny, who is a member of the Fox Rothschild Litigation Department, but also a very young attorney who's been recently elected to the Pennsylvania State University Board of Trustees. We've been talking to her about her experience there and some of the challenges faced by land-grant institutions. We're going to be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, we're back. We're speaking now with Betsy Munell, who's an attorney in the consulting business, helping attorneys have a satisfying and effective career. Betsy has two degrees from a small little place I like to call Harvard, and she was a partner at a very significant law firm where she was among the core group that helped them grow their nationally recognized practice in her expertise, media and communications finance and mergers and acquisitions. She was an outspoken advocate there for an intensive associate training, and then she put her money where her mouth was. She dropped the legal business and got into coaching and consulting, opening up a firm in 2009 to help law students and associates and even young partners navigate their way through what is now a very troubled and challenging economy, and making the legal profession all the more challenging as well. She lives up in Boston, and she's joining us today to talk about the new crop of young associates who have come to law firms around the country, or those who are in their first few years of practice, and what they can do to improve their chances of being a success. So, Betsy, I literally, as I was telling you during the break, sat yesterday with our first-year associates and talked to them about how to be a success. So, young lawyer knocks on your door at the firm and asks for the keys to success, but you can only tell them one thing because you're a busy woman. What are you going to tell them?
Well, that's a question, in fact, that I get all the time. You know, tell me quick so I can move on and go do my work, because I can't stress enough how important it is for young lawyers to have a plan, in fact, for developing their career. And the best advice I could give them, if I only had 30 seconds, was to tell them to ignore a lot of the advice that they will receive, often from seasoned lawyers, sometimes from the professional development or marketing directors at their law firm. And that advice often comes in this form. Don't worry. Don't worry about marketing right now. Don't worry about business and clients. We'll talk about that in 3 or 4 years. Right now, your very best plan is to put your head down and become the best lawyer you can be. Hit your billable hours targets. Do a good job. And in a few years, the business will come. And that all sounds smart, because, of course, you want to become the best lawyer you can possibly be. And, of course, you have to hit those billable hours targets, because for some reason we continue to evaluate our work for client purposes on the basis of the number of hours instead of the quality of the work. But it's absurd advice. It's very, very risky if it's followed. If you have demanding obligations in the office, some of them have to be non-billable. No matter how much work you have to put in to get your assignments done, it's essential to protect yourself and build a strategic professional network and begin to develop the business generation skills that can make you self-sustaining. If you don't do that, then you'll be behind all of the colleagues you know in the business world who are on message from the get-go. And you'll find yourself at risk down the road when you have to depend upon other people for your work, for your business, instead
Betsy,
of yourself.
I know one of the analogies you use is this is about juggling your priorities. And you mentioned that billable work is not always the be-all, end-all to the successful start of a young legal career. So how do you juggle the demands for building a career and starting to get some expertise in an area via billable work and then non-billable professional activities and, oh, yeah, maybe save some time for your significant other, your family, your friends?
Right. That's daunting. It's always been daunting. It's daunting for me many decades ago, but it's still daunting. It's very tough. But what I think the best way to explain this to young lawyers, to any lawyers, frankly, is to understand that you can run parallel tracks in your career. That those tracks don't have to all be billable, but they're all related. If you are working hard at developing your relationships with the partners you work for example, then the best way to do that is become indispensable. That's not complicated. It's not rocket science. It's not easy to do, but it's something you've got to learn to do before you can learn to develop business, because that's what that partner has learned to do for his or her clients. So a lot of the work that I talk about that the young people do when I'm working with them is going to pay off when they get out into the business generation events that they attend. If they've learned how to please the partner, if they've learned to be responsive, if they've learned to be innovative and creative, dependable, critical to the practice, then they will be able to do the same thing when they're representing clients down the road. It's all interactive. It's all a part of one's discipline. And the most important thing is going to be the relationships that you build as a young lawyer.
Interesting. Well, you know, one of the things I have taped to my desk, which I'm a big believer in, is having a plan. I've got my business plan taped to my desk. I've got a document on my hard drive that's a little bit longer than 1 year plan with some real long-term goals. Does a young associate need to do that? And, you know, what are some of the pieces that they need to put together?
Absolutely. They do need to do that. Everybody needs to do that. We live in an ugly world right now. It's a very tough, competitive world, a down economy. Without a plan, you're going to be wasting a lot of your time. I'm glad to know you have one. A lot of people don't, even seasoned lawyers like yourself, even partners.
Seasoned?
Often do not
that
have a plan.
Difficult.
I think it's
that sounded like you almost called me old.
What?
I said seasoned. It sounded like you almost called me old.
Oh, no, I'm old. You're seasoned. It's a distinction. But I think many young people are afraid of the word plan. They think that's going to be too complicated, too demanding. It really doesn't need to be a long-term plan. It's good to know your basic goals and whether you plan on whether you'd like to stay in practice in the law firm you've chosen. But a 4-month or a 5-month plan is good enough as long as your basic targets are clear. And, you know, I look at them as two. The first is to develop a distinguished reputation, a well-earned reputation in your firm and in the community as being an excellent lawyer and fine human being. And then the second, which goes right along with that, is to seed a rich network in your firm and in the community of talented and ambitious people who can be a source of advice, influence, superior information, ultimately, as you get older, referrals, new business, job opportunities, and the like. This is the guideline for any plan. The actual plan itself can be made up in a lot of different ways. You can do it on your own, but with some guidance, which you can obtain from people in your firm, professional development director or staff. You could hire a coach. That's smart money, but it's not essential because almost everything a coach has to tell you is available for free online. So I recommend.
I tell you, my coach was invaluable. So I wouldn't be where I am today without the coach the firm got for me a couple years ago.
Would that be Cordell? I bet that's Cordell.
He'd probably get big ears if he hears that. But he was terrific.
Well, he's superb, and that's exactly, you know, frankly, if the law firm wants to listen to some advice, it would be to be offering this kind of coaching early on and throughout
the career of the individual attorney, because it is the long play. It is an investment in the future of the individual and the future of the firm. The law firms have not been notable in their ability to make that kind of decision because their planning has traditionally and increasingly now been very short term.
Betsy, I got 1 minute left, so
yep.
Tell me two or three things a young associate can do before the end of the year, which is sort of the time when people think about, ooh, what am I going to do next year?
I'd make a list of the 10 top people that you want to develop as your relationships, whether they're mentors or they're prospects. For the young lawyer, it should be their colleagues who are in other law firms and in business, and I'd figure out a strategy for developing those relationships. I would make sure that the social media platforms available to you have been accessed, that you have profiles up, that you're following the people who are of interest in your business and in the specialty that you're interested in, particularly, for example, specialty industries. If you're interested in environmental law, that you found the thought leaders for environmental law on Twitter and you're following them.
And let me jump in,
because
we're
going to have to, and you're engaging with them.
We're going to have to go in a second. Hit me with your website.
My website?
Yep.
www.manelassociates.com.
All right, terrific. We'll have you back some other time to talk some more about these topics. That's going to do it, though, for this week's Capital Thinking.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great weekend. We'll see everybody next week.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.